Good afternoon, America. Welcome to the Inside Scoop from Washington. This is Mark Levine giving you the Inside Scoop from the Center for American Progress live in Washington, D.C. There's a lot going on in the world. Most of it, bad news. Sorry about that. I can't really help that fact. That's usually what we hear when we hear on the news. Well, Apple's coming up with a new product tomorrow. That's good news, I guess. But the rest is bad news, and we need to talk about it. I mostly want to focus on foreign policy today, but before I get there, if you live in Virginia or near Virginia or around Virginia, or you just care about money and politics, then you certainly follow the fact that the governor of my home state, and I live in Northern Virginia, just outside of Washington, D.C., the governor of my home state, Bob McDonnell, was just convicted of 11 counts, his wife of 8 counts, of basically bribery. That's not exactly the name of the charge, but in essence, he was taking money from a businessman hoping to promote his tobacco product. This was his healing tobacco product, apparently to use chemicals from tobacco to help people's health, which if it seems counterintuitive, now you know why he had such a hard time selling his product. But he gave the governor, Bob McDonnell, and his wife, Marie McDonnell, all kinds of special gifts and loans and Rolex watches, and he paid for their daughter's wedding, catering, and golf trips, a whole bunch of nice things. And the governor gave the businessman promotion of his product. His wife promoted the product. They did it in the governor's mansion. He took a look into a study of how the Virginia government could promote this product. And the question was it a quid pro quo? The governor insisted, I just do this for anybody. I do this for any constituent. And if my wife made promises, well, I'm not that close to my wife. And she's kind of got a bad spending habit. And he basically spent the entire trial trashing his wife. Now, what makes this more interesting, I think, is the fact that Bob McDonnell was a scion of family values. I mean, he was the guy who wrote a brief in college all about Christian values, about the wife should obey the husband and the husband should be the center of authority, and basically your beaver cleaver type world, which I don't think it even existed in the 1950s, but it was at least pretended to exist in the 1950s, way, way out of touch today. How ironic that a man who spent his whole time telling American men and women to live in the leave it to beaver type world and that a woman shouldn't work outside the home, all kinds of things, that he's the one who would spend his entire trial trashing his wife. The jury didn't buy it. They said, we think they did talk, and after all, Bob McDonnell did get a lot of these benefits. And even though it was only $177,000, which is relatively cheap when you think about it, buying off the governor of a state, he was found guilty on 11 counts. What I find fascinating about this trial, in addition to the clear misogyny of it all and just the fact that you find that the people who are most talking about, you know, protecting women from such evils as abortion and birth control are the ones who are quick to trash them when their own rear end is on the line. What I find interesting about it is what it says about money and politics. See, Bob McDonnell actually had a decent defense, and it wasn't to trash his wife. His defense was, people do this all the time. Politicians accept money all the time. They accept loans. There was no specific law in Virginia against accepting gifts. We do that, and we do benefits for our constituents all the time, and you can't prove a quid pro quo. This isn't like the Duke Cunningham, the San Diego congressman, who actually wrote down, if you give me this much, I'll give you this bill. And if you give me this much, I'll write this letter. That was silly. You should never put out a price list. Remember this, politicians. Don't put out the price list. Don't write it down. And McDonald said, I would do this for all my constituents. Perhaps that's true, but it also is true that within 6 minutes of coming back from a really nice golf vacation on some, I forget how many thousands of dollars it cost. Within 6 minutes of that, he came back and was already looking at ways to promote Johnny Williams' product. So the reason I bring this all about is that what's shocking to me is not that the McDonald's were convicted. What's shocking to me is that they actually had a decent argument that what they did was legal, because it happens all the time. And that's why the United States Supreme Court has found that bribing politicians is perfectly fine. Well, they didn't quite phrase it that way. They called it free speech, you see. We've had on the books for 100 years or so in most U.S. states a prohibition on for-profit corporations giving money to politicians. When you think about it, why are people giving money to politicians to begin with? And I say this as someone who ran for Congress myself and did, yes, ask for money for my campaign, as much as I hated to ask. Well, politicians need money because there is no public financing of campaigns, and we got to pay staff and campaign managers and field directors and, yes, those very expensive ads on TV, not to mention ads on Twitter and Google and Facebook and anywhere else we can get the word out. In my campaign, I didn't get the word out enough because a whopping 92% of registered voters didn't vote. That's right. The turnout was 8%. Maybe if I had another $1 million, I could have gotten more people to vote. That's how it works. It's crass and it's ugly. And that's why politicians need money. But the question is, who's going to give a politician money? And I don't mean to insult donors out there. When I give a politician money, I do so because that politician represents my beliefs. I want someone who's going to fight for the beliefs that I believe in. And that's what citizens do. That's what they should do. I wish that, frankly, we didn't give our private money to politicians, because that aids people who have money and doesn't help the voices of people who don't have money. In fact, if it were up to me, we'd have public financing. The government would give every American, $100 or so to spend on any politician or politicians they want. Then when you think about it, 300 million people, $100, that's $30 billion. That's actually a significant amount of money. That's about 10 times spent on the presidential race. That would actually make a major difference in our politics, and it would really be one citizen, one chance to express their vote, to express their preference, to get the word out for the politicians they care about. And in my system, what it would do is simply you could take it, you know, take it from ordinary taxes, but what it would do is basically make sure that you couldn't keep the money, you couldn't keep the $100, you could only spend it on some kind of political speech. Now, the Koch brothers, they're outmatched. I mean, $30 billion by all Americans, that's about the total wealth of one Koch brother. So they'd have to spend his total wealth, and all the American people combined actually would have as much power as one Koch brother. That would be good. That'd be much better than the current system. In any case, the United States Supreme Court held that rich people have a right to buy unlimited amounts of politicians, and poor people, well, they just can't afford them. Now, you can't buy a politician quite so, you know, go through your drive-through and get one to go the way that maybe Bob McDonald could be bought or Duke Cunningham. You've got to give the money to the politicians, and there are still some limitations. There's still some numeric limitations. So you have to set up a corporation, probably best if you do interlocking corporations with anonymous people, and even better if you can get it to be nonprofit, because actually political speech isn't nonprofit. It's not the same as giving money to your charity. But if you manipulate the system and pretend that you're not a political organization, as, for example, Tea Party groups did, they said, yeah, we want to promote the Tea Party, but we have nothing to do with politics. We want to elect Republicans. We don't care about politics. We want to kick the Democrats out of government, and what we do has absolutely nothing to do with politics. And they said it with a straight face. And those who are complaining about the IRS scandal are basically saying, how dare the IRS scandal not believe that the Tea Party wasn't political? You got that? How dare the IRS believe the Tea Party wasn't political? Because if they believed they were political, they weren't supposed to give them the tax-exempt status. I bring all this up because today there's going to be an amendment, a constitutional amendment, put forward on the floor of the Senate to overturn the Citizens United decision. the very Supreme Court decision that allowed corporations to break the law, to break the law passed by the various states and by Congress, because the Supreme Court said the Constitution trumps the law, which it does. The Constitution allows for free speech and the right of rich people to take other people's money against their will and spend it to promote their politics, apparently is what the U.S. Supreme Court calls free speech. Bribery is as American as apple pie. And without allowing corporations to spend money, how else are you going to collect billions of dollars and funnel it to a corporation? And I want you to think about how corporations get their money and what they're supposed to be used for. Corporations raise money, mostly through public offerings and in the stock market from shareholders. Also, of course, by selling their products, making a profit. And that profit is supposed to benefit shareholders. That's the whole point. That's why shareholders put money in the corporation to begin with, right? So the corporation is raising money for the corporation. It has to make the corporation wealthier. Now, it's not supposed to go to the coffers of the CEO, the chief executive officer. It's not supposed to be, oh, I have a corporation and all the money. It's not going to promote a better product. It's not going back to the shareholders. It's just going into, oh, I don't know, Ted Cruz, because I'm a conservative Republican, or whoever the Koch brothers want. And the Koch brothers, for example, right? Their money shouldn't go into Rick Santorum because they happen to agree with his views on abortion. If the Koch brothers want to give their personal money to a politician, well, I can't complain about that. But should they be able to give money of people who simply invest in their companies to make a profit? Well, the Supreme Court said, sure, they can. Absolutely, they can. It doesn't have to be their money. You could spend other people's money. And the reason is quite simple. Why do corporations give money to politicians if it's not to promote the personal politics of the CEO? And regularly, he's not supposed to do that. He's not supposed to treat the corporation like his personal plaything. This isn't a case of a wholly owned 100% corporation. This is a public corporation. And the CEO is supposed to promote the corporation. He's not supposed to take that money on golf trips. He's not supposed to take that money and spend it on his favorite politician. It's supposed to be done to promote the company. Well, why would a corporation spend money to promote the company? Well, because that corporation believes that paying a politician money will get them more money back from that politician. Think about it. If you're going to spend, if you're a corporation, you're going to spend $1 million on a politician and you get nothing back for it, you have broke your fiduciary duty. You have wasted that money. The shareholders are out of luck. But if you take that $1 million and you get $100 million back from taxpayers, you're a good CEO and you've also just committed bribery. So which is it? Bad CEOs or bribery? Either way, the Supreme Court has just endorsed dramatic incompetence or bribing our national leaders. Today, the Senate has a chance to overturn the Citizens United decision. And I hope all of you call your senator and ask them to make bribery illegal once again by voting for an amendment to overturn Citizens United. Thank you for that, Mark. This is Mark Levine. If you want to call it, it's 888-653-7543. We'll be right back right after this. Welcome back to the show. This is Mark Levine talking about the Citizens United decision, and then I'm going to move on after the break and talk about foreign policy, because the president is apparently going after ISIS. And while I'm okay with that, I think it's a good thing. I think we need to explore the larger context of what's going on there. And also to concentrate on the fact that, as far as I'm concerned, Putin and Ukraine actually poses the bigger danger. That's in no way to discount the great danger that ISIS causes. I actually think it's more dangerous than Al-Qaeda, but I would argue Putin is even more dangerous. So if you agree or disagree, give me a call. Let me know when we come back, 886-537-543. But on Citizens United, I just wanted to say the vote is today, and it's a very important vote. It's part about taking back our democracy and remembering that we as a nation do and should have the right to control our politicians and to decide who actually gets elected. It's shocking to me, I must say, as a former candidate, how few Americans vote. And yet we're the first to complain about our government. We're the first to say that Congress or the president isn't doing the right thing. I complain too, but at least I complain on the air, and I do vote every chance I get. So as we're fighting for keeping Americans' right to vote, as we're fighting to keep big money out of politics, don't forget to actually go out and vote this November. In fact, the control of the Senate is almost certainly at stake in a number of states, and every one of us has a chance to vote in the House elections. And so please do not forget to vote. In the meantime, I do hope you'll call the Capitol switchboard. I can give you the number, 202-224-3121. You can call in the break. But let your representatives know, let your senators know that you want to overturn the Citizens United decision, that you don't believe that big money should control our politics, that you actually think that politicians should be elected based on, I don't know, what of their views are popular with the voters. The irony is, and we'll talk about this when I get back, is that I'm going to be complaining a lot about the non-democracy in Russia and how they're trying to take it away from the people of Ukraine, or how ISIS is trying to impose their really grim view on a number of people who don't want it. And if we're going to really focus on the right of people to choose their rulers abroad, we absolutely need to focus on it here at home. This is Mark Levine. The toll-free number is 888-653-7543. I'll be right back right after this. Welcome back to the show. This is Mark Levine. The world is a mess today. Have you noticed? It seems to be falling apart before our eyes. And the main hotspots, obviously, are the Middle East with ISIS and Iran and Syria and Iraq, and also Ukraine, where Russia continues to invade its neighbor to basically annex it, which to me gets surprising little news. We'll get to those in a bit. First, I want to start by talking about Scotland. You know Scotland, don't you? The northern part of England? Wrong. It's not the northern part of England. It's the northern part of Great Britain. England and Scotland are different. Well, they were different nations. England, Scotland, Wales, and Northern Ireland are the four parts of the United Kingdom, which has been united since about 1800, a little more than 200 years. England and Scotland united way back in 1707, and their monarchies united back in the early 1600s, when Queen Elizabeth left the throne and they put on King James, who was both King of Scotland and King of England. In other words, these two parts, the northern part and the southern part of the island we call Britain, have been together a very long time. They may just split apart. There's a vote today in Scotland to declare independence from the United Kingdom, which I guess would become the United Kingdom of England, Wales, and Northern Ireland, as Scotland seeks out anew. Now, for all intents and purposes, England is the largest and most powerful of the four parts of the United Kingdom, which is why so many people use interchangeably the words England and UK and Great Britain. Great Britain is technically all of the Isle of Britain, which is England, Wales, and Scotland, but not Northern Ireland. So the Scottish tend to be more liberal than the English, who are actually more liberal than Americans. They also have a certain amount of oil and think they can basically pay for their independence through that oil. I don't know if it's true or it's not, but there's definitely a Scottish mentality, and I'm of the belief that really, as long as there's no slavery or other evil things going on, that secession might make sense for Scotland. I don't see this the same way for Ukraine. In fact, I've condemned the Russian invasion of Ukraine, which basically is because Russia wants to annex a part of Ukraine. What's the difference? And by the way, I'm not saying I'm pro-Scottish secession. I'm saying I wouldn't mind it. And I don't think it would be as big a deal as people are saying. Scotland and England would remain on the same island together. They'd remain very close. They'd both remain part of the European Union, to be sure. They would still be each other's largest trading partners. I think Scotland and England would largely become a lot like the United States of America and Canada, our neighbor to the north. Very friendly. Most people, when they think of North America, they think of the USA. Canada may be a bit of an afterthought. Poor Scotland's probably in the same boat as compared to England, because the population of Canada is about a tenth of that of the United States, and the population of Scotland is much smaller than that of England. So that's true, and yet I don't see any great animosity between America and Canada. I remember that great South Park movie, Blame Canada, was funny, because we would never blame Canada for anything. There have not been hostilities between the United States and Canada for 200 years, ever since the War of 1812 that we commemorate, this year, because it extended to 1815, the British actually burned the capital of Washington 200 years ago. The point is that Scotland, were it to secede from England, and I say, if they wish to secede, go for it, Scotland. That's certainly your decision to make and not mine, but would not radically change much, even though Scotland has been part of England for 200, 300, arguably 400 years. Compare that with what's going on in Ukraine. In Ukraine, you do have probably a state more different than England and Scotland. Apart from an accent, they both speak English. In Ukraine, the people speak Ukrainian and Russian. Both are languages of the Ukrainian state. And no doubt, there is some difference politically between East and West. The western part of Ukraine, which was carved out of the nations of Western of Europe, I won't say Western Europe, Eastern Europe, carved out of Poland and so forth. In fact, much of Western Ukraine was Poland prior to World War II. Naturally looks west, wants to be part of the EU, wants to be part of NATO, wants to be part of Western democracy and capitalism and economic strength and political freedom. The eastern part of Ukraine, interestingly, probably also wants this, largely wants this as much as the West, but to a lesser extent. Many of them have their first language as Russian. Some of them look to Russia for Russian culture. So why am I agnostic about Scottish secession from England? I think it could be more interesting. Might lead to more tourism to Edinburgh. And yet so dramatically opposed to it in Ukraine. Because in Ukraine, the Russian invasion would take a free country and take it behind the Iron Curtain. Scotland, with England as part of the UK, without England, will largely not change. But if Vladimir Putin, the dictator of Russia, succeeds in occupying eastern Ukraine the same way he succeeded in occupying Crimea and annexing it to Russia, that is a threat not just to Ukraine, but a threat to free peoples everywhere. It is a threat to the Baltic states, Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, who were part of the Soviet Union but are now part of NATO. It is absolutely a threat to Poland, always on the front line, always scared, looking east to Russia and west to Germany. But right now, it's definitely east to Russia that they are most afraid. Putin is trying to reclaim the Soviet Union. And Russia is not a free country. Russia arguably was on the path to freedom when the Soviet Union collapsed, when Boris Yeltsin was in charge. And at that time, it had some free speech. It had some free press. It had some semblance of democracy. It was moving on. It was becoming a democratic nation. But it's very hard to have a new democracy, particularly in territory that's not used to it. And so Putin, former KGB operative, basically took over, and we are where we are. If Russia's invasion of Ukraine succeeds, and I realize Russia is doing it under the semblance of it being a separatist movement within Ukraine, and while there are certainly a few people in East Ukraine that want to be a separate country, I think there are very few. Polls show they're a minority. And most of the people in there are basically Russians trying to grab that area for Russia. That's very, very different. If Scotland declares independence from England, that is a true vote for independence, for difference, for autonomy. if Ukraine invaded by Russia is annexed by Russia, that's not a vote for independence. It's a vote for dependence. It's a vote against freedom. It's a vote to remove the free press they have. The freest, largest Russian press in the world is in the Ukraine. That's, by the way, a good trivia question. Ask your friends, where is the largest free Russian press in the world? The answer is Ukraine, free Russian language press. It's not in Russia. It may be larger in Russia, but it's not free. It's controlled by Vladimir Putin. And yet the Ukrainian Russian-speaking population is quite large, larger than if any Russian-speaking populations in the United States or anywhere else around the world, and they have free speech. And that's why I think it's vital when NATO meets this week that they get together and come up with some very tough sanctions for Russia. There's supposed to be a ceasefire. Don't believe it. It won't hold. It already isn't holding. Already there's shots fired. Ukraine is trying to keep this ceasefire because they don't want more of their country to be invaded. I don't think it'll last very long. So, yes, I see Scotland and Ukraine as very different situations. And speaking of other areas of the world where democracy is hard to put in place, let's talk about Iraq. Iraq, a country where the two main ethnic groups are Shia Muslims and Sunni Muslims, with the Shia being in the majority, but they live mostly in the eastern, southeastern part of Iraq, where the Sunnis basically live in the west, in the northwest. In the northeast, you'll find the Kurdish population, which is a separate population. They're not Arabs, they're Kurds, different language, although they are Sunni Muslim. The Kurds, by the way, are the most peaceful, prosperous, and pro-American part of Iraq, and I've long supported independent Kurdistan. But the Shia majority used its democratic rights to elect a leader in Iraq, Prime Minister Maliki, who ignored the Sunni, Kurdish, and other minorities, like the Christian minority, the Yazidi minority. He basically put Shias in power, and the Sunnis were mad, and they didn't want to support Maliki. And so when these radical Islamic terrorists came from Syria, they were likely to accept them, not because they agree with them, but because they were anti the Iraqi government. Well, now this has finally gotten President Obama to do something. And he announced yesterday and today that he is going to basically work to get rid of ISIS. And ISIS is very dangerous, the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria. It is dangerous. It is more dangerous than Al-Qaeda, if only because it controls more territory and it has more money and better weapons, largely because it's being funneled weapons by some of our allies, places like Saudi Arabia and Qatar, that didn't see the Free Syrian Army as having a great success. The point of all of this, though, is that just because ISIS is bad doesn't mean the people fighting against it are good. Remember, ISIS came up largely in response to Assad, the dictator of Syria, that was busy killing Syrian citizens. And I argued a long time ago that we needed to help the free Syrians, not through weapons. I think we've learned that was a mistake. Giving weapons to them means those weapons can be turned over to terrorists, but through basically what we did in Libya, no-fly zone, to keep the Syrian government from dropping bombs that flattened villages, and they've now killed 200,000 people. Now I'm afraid it's very little and very late, and it's not clear what we should do, because while I'm all for stopping ISIS, I don't want to help Assad. I don't want to help Iran. I don't want to help all the many other very terrible groups in the region. So maybe we should focus on protecting the people who have shown them worthy of protection. The Kurds, first of all. People who really do believe in freedom, who have a long tradition of democracy and of respecting minorities. After all, it was the Kurds that protected that Yazidi population, that other religious group. So be wary. And I just have to say that I think President Obama is being a little reactive, both in Ukraine and in the Middle East. And had he been a little more careful ahead of time, maybe these things wouldn't have gotten that bad. Let me go to Dave in Arcadia, California. Dave, welcome to the show. Line one.
Mark, hi. I do feel, I guess I have an unpopular view, but that we, the United States, have so much to try to explain and to justify to the rest of the world. I believe we're deceived on all fronts by the rest of the world. I believe we're deceived on all fronts. I believe that. I really believe that we are controlled and run by a very greedy 1%. We are being governed by, in effect, Halliburton, Bechtel, Lockheed Martin, Boeing, General Electric, and their greed. And so we are disinformed and we are lied to. So now as we look to what's really going on in the rest of the world, I have to wonder, where do I go to get the truth? That's driving me.
Well, that's a fair question. And I, the only answer I have for you is to look at a number of sources. One of the things that I try to do is try to get sources from the people themselves, which I think is sort of the best source. But the other thing is that most of these groups are, no one's perfect. It's not black and white. The world is an ugly shade of gray, and lots of people have, they all want different things. I would prefer to set up some bright lines. And one of my bright lines, particularly for NATO, for Europe, is that we, under Jack Kennedy, we defended Berlin. We basically kept the Soviets from taking that city. And I would like to see, at least in Europe, where I have a clear country, in this case Ukraine, that is striving to be a free country. It's got problems, it's got corruption, but its essence is a country striving to be a free country. That's where we need to help. And I'm not saying boots on the ground, anything like that, but I think that sanctions on Russia are absolutely necessary. It's a clear case of aggression. ISIS is much uglier, and there's ISIS and there's al-Nusra, which is part of al-Qaeda, and Iran's there, and Syria's there. And while I do trust the Kurds, and I do think the Free Syrian Army means well, it's a much more difficult situation to deal with.
Well, you need to look at, Mark, how do we in a democracy where the people can vote, what's in our own best interest, how can we benefit the people, as they have done in much of Europe, certainly Finland, Denmark, Scandinavia, but we end up being where we have this fraction of 1% controlling 51% of our government.
Well, you're absolutely right about that, which is why, Dave, I began the program by talking about the Citizens United decision, because getting money out of politics, totally apart from foreign policy, which is more complicated and difficult, but protecting us at home, the best way to protect us at home, I think, is public financing of campaigns and overturning rulings like Citizens United that allow the 1% to have so much control over our government. I got to go, though, Dave, because we got to talk about a news service coming up. I'll be on, though, so you know, Dave, and everybody else, I'm going to be on for 3 hours, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday. You can hear me all this week, so there'll be plenty of time for us to talk. I guarantee you the international crises are not going away, nor is the problem of big money in politics. In fact, I'm going to have a guest specifically to talk about Citizens United tomorrow. So stay tuned for that, Dave. Stay tuned for Talk Radio News Service coming up right after these messages. This is Mark Levine. Welcome back to the show. This is Mark Levine. We've got Victoria Jones from the Talk Radio News Service on line two. Hi, Victoria. How are you?
Hi.
So first, let's start with ISIS, because the president has announced a new strategy. Will Congress support it?
Well, you know, it's very interesting. I was at the White House briefing today, and Josh Earnest was being peppered with questions about what did the president mean about getting buy-in from Congress. And you know, is he going to seek a vote from them, and what happens if they don't buy in, and all this kind of stuff. And it's really not clear. Now, two lawmakers in the House and Senate today introduced separate bills authorizing military action.
Republicans, Democrats, bipartisan, who were they?
Separate bills. Democratic Senator Bill Nelson from Florida and Republican Representative Frank Wolf of Virginia.
What's the difference between the Democratic bill and the Republican bill?
Nelson's authority to order airstrikes, but it limits the authority to 3 years and also does not allow the president to deploy ground troops. And Wolf does allow, says nothing about ground troops, doesn't forbid them, and includes no time limits.
So actually the Republicans would ironically give President Obama more power than the Democrats to conduct military action.
That's correct.
And if that's true, does this reflect the views of their parties, or is this mostly just Frank Wolf and Bill Nelson?
I think this is Frank Wolf and Bill Nelson, but because that's a particular branch of the Republican Party, you've also got the isolationists, too.
Could President Obama win a resolution for force on ISIS?
I think it would really, really depend what that resolution said. I know that sounds like a cop-out, but
it's a fair thing. I mean, I was fascinated when the Republicans, who largely complained about President Obama in Syria, that when he went to them for support, they sent attention, something that shouldn't surprise anyone, about the real horror of domestic violence. Why was Josh Earnest, the presidential press secretary, why was he commenting on that?
He was commenting because the news that Rice had been cut from his team came during the briefing. Somebody asked him about it. And he said that the president and vice president were very strong on this and that they called for men to step up and step forward and be against women, that they cannot be treated like this.
Well, that's certainly true. Victoria Jones, thank you very much for calling in. And let's all remember that domestic violence is in every population, rich and poor, black and white, United States and around the world. It has to be stopped. This is Mark Levine. Follow me on Twitter at Mark Levine Talk.